Now, as I said just now, I'm delighted to be joined today by Mike Davis at the Ready Tower Museum. And we're going to be looking at how Christmas was celebrated in Tudor times. But clearly, there would have been a huge difference between how the event would have been celebrated by the moneyed classes and the rest of us hoi polloi. So what more can we say that would cover Tudor Christmases in general, Mike?
Scott, lovely to be with you again.
Happy Christmas, I forgot to say that.
And to you.
Thank you.
The Tudor period was between the years 1485 and 1603. And if we were to have had a walk around Rayleigh at that time, you would see several familiar sights we still see today. The Rayleigh Town Museum building had been in existence for over 100 years. Holy Trinity Church had existed for over 450 years. The remains of Rayleigh Castle could still be seen. Residents enjoyed a weekly market, as they still do today. Residents enjoyed an annual Trinity Fair, as we do today. A windmill was in town, although not the present one. But there was no Dutch cottage. The A127 arterial road was a gleam in the future. Of course, no railway, no turnpike road system, with a population only about a few hundred. Indeed, the Tudor Rose is incorporated in the town's crest. But a Tudor Christmas was a time for communities to come together, to visit neighbours and tenants. For the Tudors, the 40 days before Christmas, sometimes known as Advent, was a season of atonement in which good Christians prepared themselves spiritually for the coming of Christ. The devout were supposed to do penance and fast, avoiding meat, cheese and eggs. And Christmas Eve was definitely for fasting, and you were not allowed to eat cheese, eggs or meat, but there was an established tradition of telling ghost stories by the fireside, particularly on that day. It was a thrilling way to while away the hours on dark winter evenings. For centuries, the belief had lingered that the veil between the world and the next was at its thinnest at the time of the winter solstice, the longest night of the year, and that spirits could walk on earth.
Now, they might have done a lot of fasting, but they didn't all make up for it later on, didn't they?
They did indeed, indeed. Scott, indeed, all the work, except for looking after the animals, would stop and not restart again until Plough Monday, the first Monday after Twelfth Night. In that period, people would visit their neighbours, sharing and enjoying the traditional minced pie. The pies would have included 13 ingredients representing Christ and his apostles, typically dried fruit, spices and, of course, a little chopped mutton in remembrance of the shepherds.
And what about the festive food in general? Serious feasting would clearly have been the preserve of the royalty and the gentry, but what about everybody else?
Well, indeed, because, of course, in those days, Scott, there were no fridges or freezers, so everything was fresh.
Yeah.
For Christmas dinner, all social classes enjoyed the seasonal favourites, brawn, which is a dish made from a head of a pig or cow. But in wealthy households, the first course was traditionally a boar's head that had been boned and stuffed with forcemeat, which is a mixture of ground lean meat, smeared with mustard, dressed in herbs and fruits, with perhaps a roasted apple in its mouth, and garnished with gilded rosemary, bay leaves, spice fruits, or a sprig of yew, whitened with egg or flour to make it look as if it had been dusted with snow. The dish would be ceremonially carried in, resplendent on its platter, by a steward or the head of a household. And a representation of such a feast can currently be seen in the Rayleigh Town Museum.
I knew you'd get that one in. So no sign of turkey then?
Well, in fact, turkey was first introduced into Britain around the year 1523, when Henry VIII, being one of the first people to eat it as part of the Christmas feast, it had been added to the repertoire of popular Christmas dishes by the end of the Tudor period, sometimes served instead of peacock or swan, although it would be centuries before it fully ousted them. Or the traditional meats, but plum porridge, a thick broth of mutton or beef, boiled in a skin with plums, spices and dried fruits, breadcrumbs and wine, was much enjoyed as an appetiser to line the stomach before the rich dinner to come, which included a Tudor Christmas pie, which was a sight to behold, but not one to be enjoyed by a vegetarian, as it consisted of a turkey stuffed with a goose, stuffed with a chicken, stuffed with a partridge, stuffed with a pigeon. All of this was to be put in a pastry case amazingly called a coffin, and was served salmon by jointed hare, small game birds, and wild fowl. Small pies, known as chewets, had pinched tops, giving them the look of small cabbages or shallots.
Well, no wonder it was called a coffin. You'd probably be in one after shoving down that little lot, eh?
But, Scott, don't forget the mince pies. They were known as Christmas pies and were huge and made with shredded leftover meats, preferably mutton.
I don't think I can take any more.
Well, you have to remember that throughout Britain, the Christmas period was a time for liberty, relaxation and subverting the rules. For a few days, status took second place to revelry, and role reversal among the hierarchical ranks of society and between the sexes. In 1564, for example, Mary, Queen of Scots, had, so to speak, abdicated so that two of her maids, who were also called Mary, could share the role of Queen of the Bean. At the same time, festive license served to underline the normal rules of those who participated. No one forgot who was really master and who was servant. In Scotland, the 12 days of Christmas were called the Daft Days. Even the king had to obey the commands of the Lord of Misrule. In the first year of Henry VIII's reign, his Lord of Misrule impudently asked his sovereign for £5, a considerable sum, towards his expenses. "If it should like your grace to give me too much," he added mischievously, "I will give you none again. And if your grace give me too little, I will ask more." Apparently, Henry was greatly amused.
I'm pleased to hear it.
The festival is thought to have originated from the benevolent Roman masters who allowed their servants to be the boss for a while. And even the church got in the act by allowing it's fancy dress time, Scott, a choir boy, yeah, to dress in full bishop's regalia and conduct the church services, although Henry VIII abolished this practice, although a few churches today still continue the practice.
Really? Where?
Well, Hereford and Salisbury, and you may be surprised to know that carols flourished throughout Tudor times as a way to celebrate Christmas and to spread the story of the Nativity. Whilst Christmas was outlawed by Parliament in the year in England in 1647, it had already been outlawed in Scotland in 1640, a ban that lasted until 1958. So it's hardly surprising that carols remained extinct until the Victorians reinstated the concept of oldie English Christmas.
So how was the end of Christmas marked?
Well, in big households, a sumptuous banquet would have marked the 12th night, for which an enormous cake was traditionally baked, containing dried fruit, flour, honey and spices. Inside the cake were a bean, or a coin, and a pea. Slices were offered to guests as they arrived, men and women taking them from the right and left respectively. The lucky man and woman who found the bean and the pea would be king and queen of the bean, or pea, for the evening, and then they would lead the singing, the dancing and the disports. At court, the lucky recipients were often selected in advance. However, sadly, no recipe for 12th night cake survives from before the year 1803. But I think it's also worth mentioning that gifts were not exchanged until the new year, as that had been a feature of the Roman winter festival, and the custom had survived until the Tudor age.
I guess the business with the pea or bean is why we still have the Christmas pud with a threepenny bit stuck inside it or whatever.
Indeed, although I'm sure that health and safety would have a word about that in this day and age.
I think you're right. In a few moments, we'll find out what you've got coming up. Come on, Mike, tell us what you've got coming up, because you've always got super things coming up in the museum.
Almost amazingly, Scott, we've got a full inventory of events for the whole of next year that colleagues are currently working on. January and February, the history of Hockley and the photographs of Edward Francis, he who donated the mount to the National Trust in 1923. April, of course, is the anniversary of the Titanic, and we're having an exhibition on the Essex connection with the RMS Titanic. April shows us the history of the railway and the significance of the railway to our town. down. May, heritage plaques. June, July and August, of course, with schools and thinking of the holidays, sure. We've got various things for the schools. In September, we're having a wonderful map exhibition, mainly maps dating back in Essex to 1594, including globes and atlases. October, November, remembrance, and I'm sure we'll do Christmas again, and all of a sudden it'll be another year gone. So a very, very busy Christmas. We in actual fact, are opening the museum until this Saturday the 23rd, and then all my colleagues are having a well-earned rest until Wednesday the 3rd of January. So please come and see us whenever you can.
I was going to ask you when you open. So, normally you're open on...
Normally we're open on a Wednesday, Friday and Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Entry is free. We have a bungee jump option if you want to go at £25. That's a special offer.
Right.
But no, seriously, everybody's welcome.
And this is on the High Street in Rainy.
Right in the centre of town.